shadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be holy. He will be called Son of God. And now your relative Elizabeth, in her old age, has also conceived a son. And this is the sixth month for her who was said to be barren. For nothing will be impossible with God. Then Mary said, "Here am I, the servant of the Lord. Let it be with me according to your word." Then the angel departed from her. The Gospel of the Lord. Pastors do remember what members of our parish tell us, and some of the things that you say to us stick with us for decades after you say them. My wife still remembers when she was a seminary intern in Frederick, Maryland, one time with a parishioner of hers going to a mall, and as they were driving through the mall, there were no parking spaces available. My wife was getting a bit concerned because they couldn't find a place to park when this older woman driving the car said, "Let me show you what I do." She says, "What I say is this, Hail Mary, full of grace, help me find a parking space." She said, "It works." And so as they're driving around, this parishioner says, "Hail Mary, full of grace, help me find a parking space." And right where they were sitting, a car backs out and opens up that space, and they find a place to park. But we're not going to look today at what Mary can do for us. But what we are going to take a look at is what God has done to Mary. And what God has done to Mary is God has made Mary the one who bears God in the world. Mary is the one that bears God in this world. Now, we do get hung up on the question, what do you do? It's part of the normal conversation when you first meet someone. Just after name and maybe where you live or where you were raised, you ask the question, what do you do? Now, I have to admit that many times in public, I really don't want to answer that question. Because I say a pastor, either the person will stop talking immediately or the person will clean up their language when they're talking to me or they will want to make confession to me. And when I'm working out at the gym, the last thing I want is for someone to make a confession to me about what they have done. I had a colleague, Richard McCandless, who was the rector of St. Paul's Episcopal Church in Akron. He said when he would fly on an airplane and people would ask him what he did, sometimes when he didn't want to share with them, he said, "I'm into insurance." It's somewhat accurate. And they would ask, "Well, what company do you work for?" And he would answer, "Eternal Fire and Casualty." My good friend and mentor, Frank Gross, also talks about this frustration on airplanes that you sit down and quickly the question becomes, "What do you do?" And he answers, "I'm a pastor." And then the next question is, "You know, what breed of Christian are you?" "I'm a Lutheran." And then the person will say right away, "Well, this is what I believe." And isn't that fascinating? What do you do? "This is what I believe," with the need to defend their beliefs over and against who he is. And so that's why Frank has said that the question, "What do you do?" is not nearly as helpful as the question, "Who are you? Who are you?" And to answer that question, you must look upon what has happened to you, what has shaped you, what has made you who you are as you answer the question. And what I want you to know today is that God has shaped you to bear God in the world. This bearing of God in the world comes at a time when there is a dismantling of human relationships, a disintegration of how we relate to one another. I think it's important to note that in our lives, every relationship we hold has a purpose to it. And our relationships are defined by those purposes. And so I play the role of husband, I play the role of father, I play the role of pastor and neighbor and friend and citizen. We play many roles in our relationships with one another. It's how we play out those roles that shape our relationships. Now, with playing out of these roles in our relationships, these roles are based first on authority. That is, the person with whom you have that relationship has given you the authority to have that relationship with them. And so my wife has given me the authority to be her husband, and in that relationship then to act in ways that are consistent with being a husband. When I buy my property where I live, I'm given the authority to be a property owner and likewise a neighbor, and I live out that relationship. When the state of Ohio said that Andrew is your son, I was given the authority to be his father and to tell him no all the time, which is his greatest frustration in life. But along with that authority comes responsibility. How do you live out that role? Doing things that are consistent with being a husband or a father or a neighbor. And so if I have authority to be a neighbor, it's also my responsibility to make sure that something on my property does not have an adverse effect on my neighbor's property. And if my tree is about ready to fall on my neighbor's roof, I'm responsible for making sure it doesn't happen. With authority and responsibility comes accountable, that we are accountable for living to those responsibilities. If we do it, it's good. If we don't, then we are accountable for what we have done wrong. As we play out those roles in our lives and live out those relationships, that comes with then certain affirming feelings, a sense of acceptance, a sense of being honored by another person, a sense of fellowship and relationship with one another, a sense of being competent and accepted. Those good feelings come with playing out those roles. That is why regularly I insist that as you refer to me, you refer to me as pastor. Not because I want to be heavy-handed and prove that I'm more powerful, but the name pastor defines our relationship, how we exist with one another. And it fascinates me that there are still a handful of people who don't want to use that title, which tells me more than that person really wants to say. But what I think has happened is that we have set aside the roles we play and we start living for the feelings. We want to be loved. We want to be accepted. We want to be recognized. We want to feel competent. And we live for the feelings without fulfilling the obligations of the relationship. And notice then that how that redefines the existence of another human being. If we live solely for the feelings, if I live solely for the way I feel about myself, then you become an object or a product that I use to feel better about myself. And I diminish your existence to simply the one who can provide me what I want for myself. If you provide that, then I'm happy with you. If you stop providing that, I've tried to find ways to control you to offer it back to me. If you refuse to offer it to me, I will either separate myself from you, or at worst, I will seek to destroy you because you aren't giving me what I want. So as we see then, what gets played out in two young men who break into someone else's house because that house exists solely for them to find things to take to help themselves, and a young woman school teacher stands in the way of that, what happens to her? She's destroyed so that they can have what they want to satisfy themselves. It really is an outrage. See how this gets acted out so many ways and in so many places. And the Slate this year has named 2014 as the year of outrage. And what they have done is a whole collection of articles. It starts, and you can click on the date of the year, and can tell you what was the outrage of the day on social media. And the gamut runs the outrage from those who were outraged because President Obama saluted a Marine with a coffee cup in his hand as he's getting off his helicopter, to how people felt about the father who left his young son in his hot car this summer down south. In the one article of this series, Katie Waldman takes a look at what outrage really is. And she says it's this subjective experience of being furious at something that crosses a perceived line. And she looks at the root of the word outrage, which comes from the French, and the word out, or the French outré, which means beyond or outside of. And what we have with outrage is that which crosses the line. That which happens outside of what we consider acceptable. That which happens beyond what is good for people. If we look simply at this week, and using that definition of outrage, then we can see clearly how many times that line has been crossed. From the simmering and sometimes boiling anger between the relationship between people of other races and the police, to the report on the way torture was used by the CIA, to what happened to the school children in Pakistan, to this young teacher being killed, to the own violence in our city, that the lines have been crossed repeatedly. And what we are yearning for when those lines get crossed is a solution to the outrage. And there are so many solutions that are being proposed as ways to limit what is happening. There is this solution of sentiment that I love my city, I love being here in Lancaster, and I want you all to love it as well. There is this feeling of closeness and community that was captured as one person described what happened at the prayer vigil on Thursday night, that she said, I saw people hugging each other and holding each other fast, and I wished it could stay that way because it felt right for a moment. It's that feeling of sentiment and community, but it's also a feeling of sympathy that we realize that there are places in our world where there is nastiness and there is ugliness, and there are certain groups of people that have to encounter that every day, like police officers, and shouldn't we be sympathetic because they go where we are afraid to go? But all of those propose change through an emotional conversion. That if you just feel the right way, everything will change. The problem with emotion is it's not long term, it doesn't last, and when the feeling goes away, so too does the investment in making it work. there are those like our district attorney who think that increasing the sentence for those who break into people's houses will solve the problem. Move it from 1 year to 5 years. It will be a deterrent and it will keep people from doing that. I'm really not sure that will be the case. It's the challenge that our mayor put in front of us. He said, I want this to stop. It's the use of new products like body cameras. That has to be the solution, right? And so we keep putting in front of us solution after solution for what can help us stop crossing these boundaries that lead to our outrage. But the assumption behind those solutions is flawed. The assumption is that we can all start on common moral ground. Then once we agree on what the moral code is, then we can make a difference. That's not the case, because we now can't even come up with a common definition of justice. So in place of that commonality, what we have decided is we need to force our solution on top of somebody else's. It becomes a battle for power, a battle for control. Listen to the language the Lancaster newspaper used. It's time for a full court press of all the leaders of the community to make a change. That's a statement of power. Listen to what the mayor said, I won't tolerate this anymore. It's an expression of power, that I need to assert what I want over everybody else's. That's what a protest is. And sometimes protests are necessary, but they're an exertion of power to establish my way of being over and against the ways of beings that I think are going to fail us. And in living and engaging life in that way, we get stuck in a circle that will not end. It's the age-old cycle of honor and shame, where someone wins and has honor, and someone loses and is ashamed. And the goal then is the person with honor wants to stay at top, and the person who's ashamed wants what? To dethrone that person and take the top. And the cycle continues. So police officers kill black men, and the solution is to go to a police car in Brooklyn, New York, and shoot two police officers. It keeps happening. The problem we have is that we assume that we can go right from the problem to the solution, assert the solution, and solve the problem. And what that does not take into consideration is the soul and the will of the person. That the only way that we can get from the problem to the solution is that the person's heart, mind, and will are changed. And we cannot, through the use of power, change a person's heart. That is why I think this story of Mary is such a powerful story for us now. It's a woman who is transformed by the power of God to do God's work in the world. There are wonderful posts about answers that young people put to quizzes they take, and there's this one section of answers that children in parochial, Roman Catholic parochial schools make to questions their catechumenate teachers offer them, and the one question was, how was Jesus born? And the answer that this one second grader put was, because Mary had an immaculate contraption. Now, the doctrine behind that is the Immaculate Conception. And what we, in surface looking at that, assume is that the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is related to how Jesus was conceived, which is not the root of the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. The doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is rooted in how Mary was born. And it was believed that she was conceived in such a way that she was born without sin and without brokenness, so that she was fit to carry God into the world. And what that doctrine gets at is this notion that how can Mary be fit to bear God in the world? And it's because she started perfect. But I think the text gives us a different look at that. That maybe it wasn't that she was born perfect, but that God made her fit, made her right to do this work. Listen to the language in the text. It starts with the angel saying, "Greetings, favored one." Already the angel has said, "You are favored." We know nothing about Mary and her background, but she appears and the angel says, "You are favored by God, declared to be that way. The Lord is with you," an announcement that God is with you, not because of who you are, but God has chosen to be with you. And Mary says, "How can this happen?" And the angel said, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you. God will do something to you so that it happens." And the final line is, "Because nothing is impossible with God," that God transformed her life in order that she might bear God to the world. And so do you sit there and think, "I'm not good enough to bear God to the world"? Do you sit there and beat yourself up thinking, "There's something wrong with me. I keep making mistakes. I keep falling short. I can't live up to these expectations"? Do you keep regretting what you have done and all the time saying, "There's no way God could work through me"? That's not the truth. God makes you who you are. God makes you who you are. Favored ones of God. You are favored by God. And God is transforming your life so that you can bear God to the world. After being married for a couple of years, my wife and I were told by our doctor that she wouldn't conceive. And so imagine our surprise when she ended up being pregnant, and our joy at that impossibility. And then we went for our follow-up appointment, and the doctor, who was just as elated as we were about this, did the sonogram, and there was no heartbeat. We had so invested in this wonderful moment that we thought we had made happen against all odds. And we were reminded of our limitations as human beings. We are people who are broken, and if it's up to our own power, it will never work. But out of that, we were led to Cleveland Metro Hospital in Cleveland, Ohio, to this little baby named Andrew, who has become the love of our lives. New life that came out of death allowed us to love someone we didn't even know was coming into the world. God changes our hearts and our wills. God changes who we are. And as changed people of God, we can bear God in this world. bearing God in the world will upset everything the way it is right now, transform the world, and might make it right.
Thank you.